Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well. What tips do they have for you and I? And I quiz them about how they applied their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. It's episode 25. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson. Welcome. If you're new, it's lovely to have you here. If you're a regular listener, it's nice to see you back. Before I introduce today's guest, I want to share with you something that I've learned this week, as is the new ritual for season 3. And that is I've learned that you love our podcast guests, which is great because I do too. And I've had some really wonderful feedback in the last couple of weeks from listeners. Christine commented on Dr. Joe Sweeney's episode page. I'm slowly working my way through your podcast episodes from the beginning. I have to say that of all the episodes I've listened to, the one with Dr. Sweeney just blew me away. How I wish every teacher, student, parent, and politician could have the privilege of listening to this. Please get him on again. So that was Dr. Joe Sweeney's episode, Kids, Education, and the Future of Work, which I agree, Christine, was an amazing episode, a wonderful interview. And yes, we will most certainly get Dr. Joe on the podcast again. The second bit of feedback that I had, which I thought was just lovely, was from Kirsty. And Kirsty said, I just wanted to let you know that I love your podcast. I drive a lot for my work and I'm often on the lookout for interesting topics, and positive psychology is one of my favourites. I've binged them over the last fortnight and I'm now nearly up to date. As such, I now have information overload, but have thoroughly enjoyed them all. Shel Taylor, Laura Braid and Andrea Downey are standouts, but I really have enjoyed them all. So a big thank you to Christine and Kirsty and everyone who's taken the time to give our guests feedback recently. I created this podcast to share the knowledge, wisdom, ideas and experience of my really well-qualified guests, confident that they can help us all to live, learn and flourish. And it sounds like I am achieving that goal. So on to this week's episode, and I've been doing some research into population demographics. And like much of the Western world, approximately 80% of our population here in Australia live in the big cities and urban areas, which in Australia are largely positioned along our 60,000 kilometres of coastline. And if you're in this 80% living in these urban areas, you have easy access to services, including the services of psychologists. But what of the 20% living in rural areas with sometimes huge distances to travel between major towns? Well, if you're fortunate enough to live in the Shire of Loddon in northern Victoria, about 250 kilometres from Melbourne, you might access the services of today's guest. I have the great pleasure of speaking to Dr. Naomi Malone from A Life Simply Lived, a rural psychology practice located in Bort, which is a town of just under 900 people in the Mallee district of northern Victoria. And Naomi established A Life Simply Lived to help her rurally based clients to build vibrant, authentic, meaningful lives based on what they value as important. And she described herself to me as having a love for meeting people where they are and a passion for the rural lifestyle. She also has a specialist interest in eating psychology and the intersection between nutrition and mental health. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Welcome, Naomi.
Thanks, Ellen. Lovely to be here with you.
Tell me, how did you come to be in Bort? Although you're not in Bort right now, you're on holiday by the beach, but yes. Your practice is based in Bort and you live there on a farm, I believe.
Yes.
So how did that come to be?
It's all through meeting a farm boy at uni. So, yeah, I met my husband at uni. He's studying mechanical engineering and he came from Bort. And after we had our first two children, he decided he wanted to move back to the family farm. So that's what we did.
Okay, so it's you, your husband, and four children?
Four children, yeah.
Living farm life in Bort.
Living farm life in Bort, yes.
And when did you establish A Life Simply Lived and how did you come to do that?
My background in psychology was in community mental health. So once we moved up to Bort, I spent quite a few years working in general counselling in the local community health service. And then, yeah, eventually I worked in another practice in Bendigo for a little while. And then, yeah, I sort of started this eventually, just decided to go out on my own. And because we were a pretty small kind of rural service, the practice is actually very, very general. I see a little bit of most things. So at the moment, my youngest client is 4 years old, mm-hmm. and my oldest client is 92.
That's a fair spread.
So, yeah, we see a lot sort of right across the board. There's anxiety and depression, I guess, would be the two main ones. Grief and loss and trauma would probably be the other two big ones that I would see.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a particular interest in eating psychology?
Yes.
And the intersection between mental health and nutrition. So tell us, what is eating psychology?
Eating psychology. Really, it's not so much eating disorders as such, but I often say to people it's all the other things around eating other than the food that you're eating. So there's a lot around the how, the why, the who, the where, all the other things that are around food and your relationship with food other than the food itself. Although the food itself is important, I like to do a lot of work around all the other things.
Can you give us an example?
We talk a lot about, you know, reasons why that you eat other than just physically being hungry. And so working with somebody, say, who struggles with binge eating, then what are the triggers of that? So what's happening, you know, where are you? When that sort of thing is happening, is that happening around other people or is it happening when you're on your own? Are you eating food because it's there? Anyone with kids knows there's food sort of constantly around. And so are you eating food because it's there? Are you eating food for emotional reasons? Like, is it an emotional comfort? Are you eating because it's lunchtime or because it's dinner time? Are you eating because there's food left on your plate still? There's lots of rules and things that we have around food. So really in the way that I sort of approach it, that the eating psychology is all around helping people to come back into tune with listening to their bodies and what their own bodies are telling them about what to eat and how to eat and when to eat, rather than looking at all the external cues.
Okay, so rather than the rules we set ourselves or perhaps the rules from families that we've grown up with that say, this is, you know, you always finish what's on your plate or we always have a three-course Sunday roast or those sorts of, which we do. And there's much broader societal expectations, I know, about particularly, well, where I live, very foodie culture. There's a lot of discussion about food. There's a lot of focus on food, which is wonderful. There's lots of beautiful food.
Absolutely.
But, again, they're external cues, aren't they, that
yes.
highlight food for us in a way that might not always be helpful. So if people are coming to you, are they coming, if you're having this conversation with a client, is it because they've come to you with an eating or health-related, perhaps weight-related issue, or is it something broader than that?
The way that I would frame it would be to say that, you know, they've come with a difficult relationship with food okay. that they're wanting to change for some yep. reason. And often there's a medical issue. I work quite closely with a local dietitian, mm-hmm. so she'll often refer people to me to get that sort of part of the work that she's trying to work directly with the food itself, mm-hmm. and then she'll send people to me to sort of work with that other aspect of it.
Okay, yeah. It's a wonderful collaboration there in the local community.
It is. It's wonderful, yeah.
And those individuals who are coming to you, I mean, the wonderful thing from a psychological point of view is that perhaps they have got to a point where they've realised that this is not a healthy relationship that they have with mm. food and eating, and they're prepared to do yes. something, or they're looking for assistance and support to make yeah. a change in that area.
Yeah, yeah. I often see people who have been quite long-term dieters, and so they've been in a dieting sort of spiral for a really long time, and they get to the point where they realise it's just not working. So they're ready to sort of try something quite different. And it is quite different to the way that we sort of often approach it. I guess the other part of it is that, you know, we're also sort of looking at how people feel about their bodies, so their relationship with food, but also, you know, their body image and how they feel about their bodies and how they're, so there's that sort of aspect to it as well.
What are you working on in those situations? Is it identifying the thought patterns perhaps?
Yeah, for sure. Identifying where they've come from and then how they impact on the choices that people make.
And how do they receive this? Because as you say, it's quite a different way of thinking about it, isn't it? I mean, I know for us as psychologists, we understand the idea that there's all these forces that have an impact on our behaviour, including the way we think about things, but that can be quite a new way of thinking for others. How's this received, this different approach?
Yeah, mostly it's actually received quite well, because I think usually by the time people have sort of come to me, they've tried everything. They've worked on willpower, they've worked on all sorts of things, and it's just not working for them, and they feel like they're digging themselves deeper and deeper into a hole. So, yeah, mostly they're quite receptive to it. Sometimes you get people who will sort of go, oh, I really don't know how this is going to help me or how this is going to change things, but, yeah.
And does it help? Does it help them to change?
Often it does. Sometimes the change actually is about coming to an acceptance of things. So sometimes what we're actually helping people to do is come to an acceptance of their, particularly the way that they see themselves and their bodies and their relationship with food. So often people will come in with very concrete goals around, you know, particularly if it's a weight management one, they'll come in with specific goals around how much weight they think they want to lose. So they may not necessarily achieve that, but they may be viewing themselves very differently by the end of it. Yeah.
So maybe not, I suppose, reframing the goal or helping them to come, because ultimately I guess our goal, I don't know, I like to think our goal in most things is to find happiness and contentment in what we do. So, you know, I know from having spoken to a lot of people sometimes that even attaining that goal weight may not really give you it. It's like trying to achieve any kind of goal that we set ourselves, unless it's an intrinsically motivated or we understand the why for the goal.
Yeah.
You know, achieving it in itself can be a little hollow at times.
It can.
Because it wasn't really the goal. We often get mad about what the goal is, don't we? It wasn't really the goal. The goal is to find contentment. So if we can get that acceptance of who we are, those psychological components of who we are and how we feel about ourselves, how we feel about our body, how we feel about our eating and our family, whatever it might be.
That's right. Yeah. And just helping people sort of step back into enjoying themselves, enjoying their lives, enjoying their bodies, enjoying food, having all that again without all the rules and the restraints and constraints around what I should and must do.
The shoulds.
No
help to us that they really just make. So I guess that acceptance then, from the sounds of things, is like being able to almost end the battle, you know, that there is this kind of battle that we have with what we should do, what we shouldn't do, how we should look, what we should eat. And for people who have struggled with that for a long time, that would become quite an ongoing psychological battle.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, which often it actually sort of perpetuates that cycle too, particularly for people who do sort of look to food for comfort. You know, with that emotional battle comes to turning to food, and it just perpetuates that cycle. Yeah,
the ongoing battle. Naomi, the other interest you have that is parallel to this, or I suppose aligned with this, is around the intersection between mental health and nutrition. What led you to this passion?
Probably, you know, a fairly sort of personal interest, actually. I had a bit of a health journey myself along the way. And I can't even remember how long ago now it was. It must have been about 10 years or so ago. I actually became really unwell and trying to figure out sort of physically what was going on. In the end, it was that I actually had gallstones. And so that was resolved. But I actually started looking to food because there were so many things that I couldn't eat that I had to deal with. And so it was interesting just looking at the process of how to help my body deal with being unwell and what had sort of led it to that point. So my youngest child is 10. So it was actually sort of during that time, you know, very sort of quite stressful time with four sort of fairly young children at that point. And it was interesting because probably my interest was sparked in that process because I was focusing on trying to help my body through understanding nutrition and food and what was actually happening. But I also noticed through that process how that actually changed the way that I was feeling on a psychological and emotional level too through that sort of stressful period. That's what sparked my interest. And so I started doing a bit more research and became a bit more interested in what was going on from that perspective too.
But what, from a practical point of view, what did you notice yourself in terms of what you were eating and then how you were feeling?
I guess there was two aspects of that. There was the pain aspect of it, which when you're in a lot of pain, which I was when I ate certain foods, it impacts on your mood in a very negative sort of way. And then there's a stress and the worry of what's actually happening. But what I noticed was probably the more that I actually put really good fuel in, the better I actually felt, both physically and emotionally. So, and it's interesting because the two things that we're discussing today are quite parallel. So the more nutritious the food was that I put into my body, the better I felt. But just trying not to tip that over into the shoulds and the musts. So there's a balance, I guess, between the two.
Yeah, that is really interesting, that notion, yeah. Because I think, and I'm not a big one for, you know, I eat reasonably well, I think. I try to eat a variety of foods. I try not to have lots of rules around what we should and shouldn't, because I know that that's kind of setting yourself up for difficult relationships with what you're eating and again, just that internal battle. So I try to keep it fairly low key as far as food is concerned. But that is one of the struggles, isn't it? Because I know we can look at perhaps people who have had poor nutrition, who haven't made what we know to be good health choices regarding food. And then at the other extreme, we can become quite rigid around what we can and can't eat, because we know that, you know, there are certain foods that are better for us, but then we cut out all fats or we cut out all carbs, and it's just another set of rules, isn't it?
It's just another set of rules, exactly. And interestingly enough, we know that cutting out things like that is actually not good for us on a physical or a psychological level because our bodies and our brains need those nutrients, those, you know, macronutrients to be able to function. We know that our brains need good fats. And so, yeah, some of those rules that we can place on ourselves from the dieting perspective actually don't help us emotionally on a physical level.
Yeah. So what is it that we know about the role that nutrition plays in wellbeing and mental health from a research point of view?
We know that there's a few things that are happening. We know that there are nutrients, things like zinc and vitamin B, that the research is showing there's a strong link between deficiencies in certain things and anxiety, depression mostly. So low levels of zinc and B6 are associated with depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. Vitamin D is the other one. Low levels of vitamin D in your body are also associated with particularly depression. So on that, those nutrient levels, we know that the research is actually quite clear about the fact that they are related. And it's also very clear that with those deficiencies, we often sort of think about them in terms of what the impact that they have on the body. But we know that the mind and the body are completely interconnected and linked. So what's impacting on one will actually impact on the other, and that will actually go in both directions.
So if you have someone come to you with symptoms of anxiety or depression, do you talk to them about their diet?
Yeah, I do a little bit. I try to be quite careful because I'm not a dietitian. So what I will often do in the first couple of sessions is we'll have a little bit of a look at it, and I'll flag it as something that can be discussed, that we can have a little bit of a look at. And if it's something that someone wants to explore more, I'll usually kind of work alongside the dietitian. So I'll usually refer to the dietitian, but I'll pretty well always in an assessment alongside all the other things that we usually talk about, you know, social connections, sleep, movement, spirituality and, yeah, and nutrition, I'll bring it up in that sort of assessment to see as something that can be sort of looked at.
And I guess then having those conversations, it is about treading carefully because, you know, I'm fascinated by this notion of, you know, we need to think and pay attention to what we eat because we know that diet is fundamental to our well-being along with those other things as well, exercise and sleep in particular. But because of our natural tendency to establish these rules and to make things more difficult for ourselves in some ways, how do you then kind of progress down that path to find that balance? Is it just an intuitive thing or?
Yeah, it sort of is. I guess for most people it is quite intuitive. I probably address it a little bit because we're not trying to put more food rules around things. Probably I try to make it more about what they need to include rather than what they need to stop.
Okay.
So it's more about putting more nutrients in rather than what I can't have. Yeah, that sort of thing.
And that makes some sense from the point of view of, you know, we know that those what we call avoidance goals, trying to stop doing something, is much harder for us as human beings than what we might call an approach goal. So setting up something that is appealing for which we have a kind of a why, you know, just it's not about stopping eating these things. It's about eating perhaps this wider range of nutrients or foods because it will help you to feel better. And I guess at the point they've come to see you, that's what they're looking for, is to feel better.
That's right. I guess, you know, you're sort of looking at those foods and those nutrients as building blocks for the things that your body needs to be able to produce the hormones and the happy chemicals that it needs to feel good. And the other thing is, you know, in this whole equation that we haven't talked about yet is sort of the role of the gut health, because there's a lot of research coming out now. We know that the serotonin's made in the gut, and that gut health is so imperative in how we're feeling. If that's disrupted, it becomes really hard to make serotonin, and then that's connected then with depression. And we know all sorts of things kind of impact on the health of the gut.
Yeah, and that is fascinating. I think what I find really interesting watching this from a bit of a distance, because not directly related to work that I do, but as an interested psychologist who likes to keep up to date, is just how systemic these things are, that how closely linked not only our body and mind are, because I think perhaps historically and maybe in some ways we still tend to think of physical health as being one thing and mental health as being a separate thing. You know, your mental health is somehow up here in your head, your brain, while the physical health's going on in your body, but of course it's all part of the same connected system. And I think that really brings what you were just describing there about the serotonin being the gut microbes and that process of playing a part in producing serotonin, which is that what we need to stay happy. You can almost visualize a connection then, or I know I certainly can sort of visualize a connection between what's going on in my belly and then how that's kind of distributing its way through the system, including into my brain.
Yep, absolutely. And I think one of the other fascinating things, Ellen, is that actually works in both directions. So when we're stressed and when we're feeling down, that actually impacts on the processes that happen in the gut. So it's another one of those cycles that we experience, that it actually kind of happens in both directions.
So we need to keep the system in order both ways.
Yeah, that's right.
Thinking well helps us to feel well, and feeling well helps us to think well.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
And so is this, I mean, because this is, I guess, what we call psychoeducation, so it's actually informing and helping your clients to understand how all of this works. How does that come across to them? Does it make sense? So their kind of eyes light up?
Yes, it does make sense to most people. And it is interesting because often and quite a few times now that you sort of see people, particularly, you know, people when when they're feeling really depressed, really turning to the really highly processed, I don't want to say junk food, but, you know, let me say, it's the sometimes foods, because we know, like, they give you that burst. you know, we look for the salty, the fatty and the sweet to give us that burst of, you know, of happy chemicals. So there's that cycle spiraling in that way that you're looking for those foods to give you that. And then that's impacting on your gut health and the nutrients that you're putting into your body. And so just working with our psychological strategies and then working alongside the dietitian to change the diet, yeah, it can be extremely powerful watching the difference.
What wonderful work. Mm. I do actually describe, I often say to, we're talking about stress in workplaces when I'm in a workplace presenting to a group, and I talk about our tendency, which is exactly what you described, to we'll have a really stressful day, we're really stressed about something at work or perhaps at home, but just get into that kind of busy mental mind that keeps disappearing down negative vortexes. Mm-hmm. And what that does for our behaviour and how often that means that, you know, we get home from work and we just crash on the lounge and we watch crappy TV and we eat the sometimes food, the junk food that's kind of handy to us,
yeah,
possibly in an attempt to kind of get those happy chemical hits, you know, the ice cream or the donuts or the hot chips. Yeah. And then we might just kind of lie there and continue eating and watching crappy food, and then we go to bed too late and we might have had one, maybe too many wines, and we don't sleep well as a consequence, do we?
Yep, no.
And then we wake up the next day and we're feeling sleep deprived and a bit ordinary, and so we go off to work again, and then we get through the day on the coffee and the chips and the caffeine drinks in order to keep us going, and what a negative cycle that can be. But when I describe it to people, they all kind of nod and laugh because we've all been there.
We all know
what that feels like.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right. And Ellen, it's interesting because just hearing you sort of describe that then, it reminded me, you know, just in what we were talking about earlier about the shoulds and the musts and the rules, I'll often talk to people about not actually kicking that stuff out of their toolbox because it's there and it's still a tool. Mm. It's just you're sort of wanting to encourage people to do it sometimes and not always be, so it becomes just one tool in the whole suite of tools that they can use to feel better in that moment. So rather than feeling like it's the only option, that there's other things that you can do too. And then, you know, sometimes if you choose to eat the donut on the couch watching the mindless telly, that's okay. You know, it's about that balance in the whole system.
And that puts power back in our hands, doesn't it? If we have that understanding that we've got a toolkit that we can use and there's a whole range of choices, there's no hard and fast rules, you mustn't ever reach that or you mustn't ever do this, then it's up to us, I guess, with a bit of mindfulness and a bit of awareness to make those choices to say, you know what, today I know this isn't necessarily the best choice for me, but I'm allowed it and it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. And the bit that I love the most is, and I'm actually going to enjoy it.
Yes. Savour it. Savour that donut.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, that's what it's for. Yeah. So absolutely. Mindfully eat it. You know, taste all of it. Yeah, enjoy it.
Nothing wrong with a treat as long as you being conscious about it and, yeah, enjoying it.
That's right, exactly.
So choice and mindfulness, and it's funny how often our conversations, all my conversations with my podcast guests come back to the role of mindfulness. And awareness,
mm-hmm,
in what we're doing.
Yeah.
Mindful eating is part of that.
Mindful eating, and that's it. And I think that's what it all comes down to, you know, in both of those things that we've been talking about today, it comes down to people understanding that they've got choices. And trusting their bodies again, because it is something that we almost unlearn. Children seem to do it beautifully and we unlearn it as we grow. And so getting people to kind of listen to what their bodies are telling them, whether it's, am I hungry now and do I want to eat? Or, you know, what does my body need? Or, you know, resting when we're tired or whatever it is, it's kind of coming back to that listening and trusting yourself, but being mindful and being aware of what your body's actually telling you, because it tells you a lot. If we stop and listen to it, can actually tell us a lot.
Yeah, and I guess, no, for me, I'm just, as you were talking, I was just thinking, I know that it's when I'm perhaps sitting at my desk working and doing something that involves some thinking or something that's going to be hard, and that's where I tend to kind of pause and get up and go, I just wander into the kitchen. You know, I work from home, I wander into the kitchen, see if there's something to eat. And over time I've come to realise that I'm using that as the this is hard, this bit of work I have to do. I'm not sure I'm kind of willing to throw myself into it quite yet. And getting up and wandering into the kitchen is such an easy thing to do then. So I'll just have a biscuit, or I'll just, you know, I'll try to make the healthy choice and choose fruit. But, you know, it, and that comes from that awareness, just paying attention to the patterns of your behaviour and what you're doing and whether or not that's helping you or hindering you.
Absolutely.
So, Naomi, the other thing that I really wanted to talk to you about is what you consider, as somebody who didn't grow up in rural area.
Yeah.
You know, what are the wellbeing benefits, do you think, of living rurally?
Ah, yes. Okay. My passion when I'm not at work is actually growing veggies. So I love... Oh, wow. Sorry. It's a big question. I'm not sure where to start. It's a great big question. For me, having space to grow things, I'm pretty passionate about being able to do lots of things myself. So, like, I love food too. And I love to cook. And I take so much joy out of being able to pick what I grow. And knowing that there's just so much, you know, great stuff in that that I can then take in. And there's something really sort of quite nurturing. It feels like a bit of an achievement too. So if I was to try to summarize it all, it's probably actually the quite holistic nature of the whole thing. In that, you know, when I'm out there, I love to get my hands in the dirt and get things sort of going. But then the achievement of growing things, being sort of connected and present with that. But then that nutrition that's sort of coming in then, and I'm sort of feeding that. That's what I love on that aspect of things. I love to know that what I'm feeding my family is pretty awesome. Yeah. But again, in balance, you know, we still have lots of other stuff too. But at least I know that what's, you know, a lot of what's going in is really nurturing in that way. And then there's some fun stuff too. And it's all about that balance. On a social level, I think it's really fantastic. And I think especially for the kids being sort of raised in that area, there's lots of connections that would be different in a city area. So my kids have lots of freedoms that they perhaps wouldn't have, which we probably take for granted a little. So the whole idea that it takes a village to raise a child, well, you know, small community, you get a real sense of that village, which can be really fantastic. But it can also be a struggle for a lot of people too. Yeah, I see both sides of that in my practice.
Are those challenges related to, because you've described all the wonderful things that I know and we know from the research, you know, being out in nature and that kind of connectedness to the earth and with nutrition we've talked about. There's a bit of a really nice positive cycle you were describing there about that, you know, being able to grow it yourself, pick it, eat it, feed your body, giving you the energy, you know, another lovely cycle. And obviously that community and that connectedness, because we know that human connection and relationships are so important to our well-being. What are some of the struggles then for your clients in living in a pretty condensed rural area?
Travel is a big issue and accessing services is also a big issue. But probably the very thing, and it's just one of those sort of natural sort of balances in life, I guess. One of the things that I love about living in that rural, in the rural communities is that they can be very supportive. And so people generally will know a little bit about what's going on for someone and there'll be a lot of support that sort of comes around you. And that's wonderful. You know, if your children are playing in a public area and you don't have your eyes on them, someone else has got their eyes on them. And so, but that can be really hard. So people can feel like they're being constantly being watched or constantly being judged. And I find for young people, for adolescents specifically, if they don't feel like they kind of fit the mold, it's much harder for them in the rural community. So that can be a real struggle because there's almost more pressure to kind of fit this nice little mold. So people can feel that pressure too. So what's its greatest asset for some people can also be really quite tough.
Yeah, because you've described, I think, a sense of connectedness that we know is really important that reduces isolation. So people might be more physically isolated, but they're not necessarily more socially isolated, except perhaps if you don't feel your fit, in which case you perhaps might start to feel a lot more isolated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you don't have then those connections.
That's right. And I think too, the nature of farm work, and it's not just men because there's female farmers too, but for people who are farming and actually out on the land a lot, that can be quite isolating too. So there has to be more of an effort made to actually come into the social and the social connectedness.
Yeah, I could imagine if someone was perhaps struggling with a bit of rumination or some unhelpful thinking that was contributing to perhaps some depression or anxiety, spending a lot of time on your own and disconnected from someone in a big open area where there's lots of space to think.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of thinking that happens when you're just driving a tractor up and backwards and forwards in a paddock, you know, for hours on end.
And that thinking, you know, if it's helpful, you might come up with all sorts of creative and interesting thoughts. But if it's disappeared into a kind of a less helpful thinking pattern, it might. And that's interesting, that idea that people have to actually then make that conscious effort. Because I think perhaps that's something that, again, not that many people are aware of. And I know I certainly talk about it in workplaces, just how important it is to stay connected to other people, particularly if you are struggling a bit. You know, that's when we need it. And yet our natural inclination is actually to disconnect.
Yes. And for those who are working in those jobs, it's sort of naturally isolating anyway, so it can compound the issues. Yeah. I guess as a psychologist in the rural kind of areas, probably the other thing that's really interesting that I would deal with a lot are boundary issues and ethical issues around who I see. So, I mean, for all of us, confidentiality is an absolute key. And for us, you know, working in that small communities, you have to be even more than that. It has to be so fundamental to what we do, even, yeah, right down to the way we book clients, who's sort of coming in next to who. You've sort of got to know a lot about if people are connected to each other or how connected are they to me.
Yeah.
It's unavoidable. It's completely unavoidable. And the longer that you work in a small community, the more unavoidable it becomes. So you're making ethical decisions all the time around what's too close and what's going to be detrimental. And having a little bit of a network of other professionals who you can refer to is always important. But for me, it's really important too.
Really important, yeah. Yeah, just the intricacies of those social relationships. And I think that perhaps one of the other things that I've certainly noticed living in a regional area, but in a town where, you know, there are generations of people who were born here and have not left, you know, if you live in a big city, there's people coming and going all the time. People arrive, people leave, you know, there's just much more movement generally. But in our smaller communities, that doesn't tend to be the case. So you've then got intergenerational relationships as well, that I guess, yeah, it would be very complex to have to bear all of that stuff in mind whilst also getting a good grasp on an individual client's issues and how you're going to help them.
Absolutely. It's interesting because, you know, we talk a lot about cultural diversity, and I've actually come to understand in the last 5 years especially that rural communities, they're actually a culture all in of their own. Yeah. And you actually, to actually help people in the rural community, you actually have to understand the way that the rural communities, how they operate and what their specific culture is, because it is its own culture. And so, yeah, really got to understand. And people actually really appreciate the fact that you do sort of understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, that sounds like a whole other podcast topic in itself, Naomi.
Yeah.
Look, thank you very much for sharing your time and expertise with us today. I have learned a lot. You've given me some interesting things to think about in terms of that brain, body, gut, nutrition connection and the role that it plays. Are there any kind of books or resources that might be useful to people who are interested in finding out more about this?
Yep. So probably the best link that I've found is actually out of Deakin University. It's Dr. Felice Jacka at Deakin University, and she runs a centre called the Food and Mood Centre. So they've got a wonderful website which actually outlines, they've got a whole lot of resources on there, and it outlines a whole lot of the current research that they're doing research at the moment within that centre around how to improve depression, specifically how to improve depression by improving diet. So there's some interesting things coming out of that at the moment.
Excellent. I will pop the details for that in the show notes. And I will also link to your website and obviously put some of the hints and tips, some of the things that you shared with us today. I'll put all of that together so that our lovely listeners can access that and find out a little more if they're interested. I've certainly learned a lot and I really do appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ellen. Thanks for having me.
Who'd have thought that there are so many ways to think about how and what we eat and the impact that these things have on our happiness and our well-being? And if you're listening from a rural area, I hope you enjoyed Naomi and my discussion of some of the well-being benefits of rural lifestyle. If you'd like to learn more about A Life Simply Lived and Naomi's work, you can find a link to her website in the show notes for this episode. I've also added a link to the research and work being done in nutrition and mental health at Deakin University. You'll find it all at potential.com.au/podcast. Now, if you're new to the Potential Psychology podcast, and I know we have many new listeners join us for season 3, I invite you to go back and listen to the great guests I've interviewed so far this season and in seasons 1 and 2. We've covered digital parenting, building confidence, the woman's brain, helping kids to manage stress and anxiety, psychology and yoga, productivity, resilience, the well-being benefits of exercise, and plenty of interviews on performance. You'll find every episode on the free Radio Public app, which financially supports independent podcasters like me, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. And while you're there, I'd love it if you could leave a rating and review, as this spreads the word about the podcast and gives me and the team great feedback on what's working well. If you haven't already, you might also like to join the Potential Psychology community by signing up to my regular newsletter at potential.com.au/subscribe. This will keep you up to date with the latest podcast episodes and blog posts, link you up to top articles in positive psychology, performance and well-being, and give you the behind the scenes here at Potential Psychology HQ. There are plenty more fascinating interviews coming up in season 3. I will be back with one of them next week, and I'm looking forward to seeing you then.